On a snowy January morning in 1902, a train operator entering Midtown Manhattan missed the stop signs. The train pummeled into a Danbury Express train on 56th Street. The collision killed 15 people on impact. At least 40 more passengers were bruised and burned, and two died within a week.
At the time, it was the worst train accident in New York City history. There had to be a solution for the smoke from the train's steam engines that fogged the tracks.
The New York Central Railroad's chief engineer, William J. Wilgus, had a solution. While the phrase "light bulb moment" may not have been in the popular lexicon yet, Wilgus said his inspiration came to him, quote, "in a flash of light. It was the most daring idea that ever occurred to me."
Wilgus wanted to demolish the existing Grand Central Depot and swap out all the station's steam-powered trains for electric ones. Getting rid of the noxious fumes would help train operators see their path ahead. They could even run underground.
More tracks beneath the surface meant less need for bulky train sheds on street level. Wilgus figured the leftover space could house retail businesses and encourage private development. He envisioned the new station as a so-called gold mine.
And he was right. Today, Grand Central Terminal is a bustling masterpiece, spanning 48 acres and 44 platforms in the heart of Manhattan. It's one of New York's biggest architectural gemstones.
And arguably, one of the most majestic transportation hubs in the world. But any building with so much money, traffic, and history has its fair share of secrets.
Welcome to Conspiracy Theories, a Spotify original from Parcast. Every Monday and Wednesday, we dig into the complicated stories behind the world's most controversial events and search for the truth. I'm Carter Roy.
And I'm Molly Brandenburg.
And neither of us are conspiracy theorists.
But we are open-minded, skeptical, and curious. Don't get us wrong. Sometimes the official version is the truth.
But sometimes it's not.
You can find episodes of Conspiracy Theories and all other Spotify originals from Parcast for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is our first of two episodes on Grand Central Station. The train terminal, as we know it today, opened to jaw-dropping fanfare in 1913. Now it takes tens of millions of passengers where they need to go every year.
Today, we'll cover the terminal's history, from when William J. Wilgus built it to decades later, when Jackie Kennedy helped rescue it from destruction. New Yorkers later launched a massive citywide effort to restore the station back to its former glory.
Next time, we'll explore a few conspiracy theories involving Grand Central, like whether there's a secret power station in its basement, or a private train track that was reserved for use by U.S. presidents like FDR. We'll also investigate the NYPD's cruel treatment of the people who live in the tunnels beneath the station.
We have all that and more coming up. Stay with us.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Another day is here and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
It's hard not to feel goosebumps while walking through Grand Central. A celestial ceiling twinkles with paintings of Orion, Taurus, and other constellations. Outside, chiseled statues of Greek gods encircle a clock made of Tiffany glass 48 feet off the ground.
The station has designated galleries for both whispering and kissing. You can even play a game of tennis on the fourth floor, in a tucked-away venue that used to be an indoor ski slope. Before that, it was an art gallery.
Prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, Grand Central welcomed 750,000 visitors a day, making it New York's second biggest tourist destination behind Times Square.
Such a feat takes deep pockets and bold planning. The landmark that made New York City what it is today has seen its fair share of decay. Grand Central's iconic legacy is pretty unique because 150 years ago, steamships were en vogue. The businessman who popularized train travel even swore railroads off at first.
Cornelius Vanderbilt was one of America's founding tycoons. At 6 feet tall, he had a knack for swearing and spitting tobacco juice. Nicknamed the Commodore, he owned a lucrative steamboat business that made him one of the few 19th century millionaires.
If that wasn't a good enough reason to prefer ships to railroads, he almost died on his first ever train ride.
On November 8, 1833, both Vanderbilt and former President John Quincy Adams were on the Camden and Amboy train. Suddenly, a metal bearing beneath the car caught fire. The train snapped off the tracks and threatened to alter the course of history.
Luckily, Adams came out unscathed, but one person was killed instantly and another died shortly after. Plus, 23 other passengers were injured, including Vanderbilt, who broke a few ribs and punctured a lung.
The Commodore was understandably rattled. He vowed to never invest in railroads.
But by the mid-1800s, it was hard to deny where the money was. Vanderbilt switched his focus from the water to the tracks.
Vanderbilt capitalized on falling stock prices to buy the Harlem Railroad. By 1865, he also owned the much busier Hudson Line. But his eyes were always set on the New York Central.
The railroad company serviced the 300-mile stretch from Albany to Buffalo with major lines in New York City, Boston, and the Midwest. It was also becoming the go-to transportation option for Irish and German migrant workers heading west.
He knew that any burgeoning railroad empire needed the New York Central, so he did what he could to force the current owners to sell.
Vanderbilt already owned the Albany Bridge, the only way to access the country's biggest port. Every railroad company used the bridge to ship freight across the continent.
So in the winter of 1867, he simply closed the bridge. Rival railroads, including the New York Central, could no longer use it to ship millions of dollars worth of cargo. They had nowhere else to go.
With their trains blockaded, the New York Central's stockholders sold their shares. The railroad's value plummeted, and Vanderbilt was poised to buy up all the cheap stock.
His bullish power play ruffled feathers, but ultimately paid off. Vanderbilt became the proud owner of three major railroad lines.
And his timing was impeccable. New York City's population ballooned from 200,000 in 1830 to 1 million in 1867, more than tripling in less than 40 years. But its dumpy train depots were outdated and dangerous.
Vanderbilt wanted a marquee hub that suited his growing railroad empire, so he hired an architect who drew inspiration from the Palace of Versailles in France. they would build an entirely new station at 42nd Street in Manhattan to streamline the traffic. The Commodore paid for most of the construction out of pocket, for the equivalent of some $140 million today.
And on November 1st, 1871, Grand Central Depot opened its doors.
The new station had a glass roof the size of five Sistine Chapels. Its cylindrical ceiling ascended 10 stories off the ground, making it the largest indoor space in North America at the time. But despite the grandeur, not everyone loved it.
At the time, Midtown Manhattan wasn't the New York City epicenter it is today. An unnamed New York Times writer complained that Grand Central wasn't particularly grand or central.
The depot was often overcrowded, which gummed up traffic and lengthened commutes. What's more, it was dangerous. Trains coming in from opposite directions had to cross paths at two separate junctures.
Plus, pedestrians coming from the west side of the city had to dash across the tracks without a proper crossing on 4th Avenue. Visibility was low thanks to the smoke billowing from train engines. The alternative was a half-mile detour that took them blocks off course.
One angry East 50th Street resident wrote a letter to the New York Times saying, quote, "There is no single thing on New York Island so dangerous to the community and prejudicial to its interests as this Valley of the Shadow of Death."
But while pedestrians tiptoed around danger, it was hard to deny that Manhattan was soon booming. By 1900, 1.8 million people lived in the borough. Even though it ran 500 trains a day, Grand Central Depot had trouble keeping up with the growing demand.
The railroad ran through a laundry list of construction projects, both to improve safety and to accommodate more riders, but still failed to address its biggest problem, the smoke.
The exhaust made tunnels look like hellscapes. Train operators couldn't even see the rails ahead of them. One four-mile stretch of underground tracks from Grand Central Depot to the Harlem River was practically invisible. That was the site of the accident that changed everything.
The crash happened thanks to an inexperienced conductor named John M. Whisker. He'd only been an engineer at Grand Central for a few months. He usually just ran milk trains in the early mornings before there was any traffic.
But on January 8, 1902, he filled in for the engineer of train 118, who had called in sick. The train was a minute and a half late, leaving the nearby suburb of White Plains, and Whisker was eager to make up for lost time.
It's unclear whether Whisker saw the warning lights through all the smoke, but at 8:20 that morning as he entered the depot, he smashed into a parked train.
The collision killed at least 17 people.
A grand jury later indicted Whisker for second-degree manslaughter. But New Yorkers also wanted more accountability, namely from Cornelius Vanderbilt and the other top railroad officials, for the decrepit conditions that led to the crash. In the end, none of them were charged.
William J. Wilgus, the New York Central's creative chief engineer, was arguably the one who would have borne the brunt of legal trouble, but his reputation was still in the hot seat. Wilgus concluded that all his small-scale safety fixes weren't doing the trick. It was high time to replace all of the train's steam engines with electric ones, and that would require a station-wide retrofit.
He envisioned his new terminal as the brainchild of creative engineering and architectural ingenuity. They would demolish the old station and build an entirely new terminal. It would serve as Manhattan's new link between public good and private enterprise.
Wilgus was the first engineer to apply the concept of what later became known as air rights on such a big scale. Air rights refer to the idea that if someone owns a building, they also own all of the airspace above it. They can sell or lease it to developers who want to build over them at their choosing.
Wilgus thought air rights could help finance Grand Central's massive construction project, which he estimated would cost $35 million, or about half the railroad's annual revenue.
It was a project unlike anything done before, which made Wilgus's plan a tough sell for New York Central's board of directors, who owned and operated Grand Central.
The board members all knew that their railroad company made most of its money transporting goods. It wasn't clear if they'd spring for a project that primarily benefited passengers.
In the end, Wilgus's dogged belief convinced the board. They approved his proposal in June of 1903.
But first, they had to tear down the buildings that were in the way in one of New York City's largest demolition projects ever. Wrecking crews swarmed Midtown and cleared 17 acres of the railroad's newly acquired land. An orphan asylum, two hospitals, three churches, and 120 houses were razed.
But before they could build, they had to design. The railroad's chairman commissioned two architecture firms to dream up plans for the new station together.
Wilgus's project was becoming a reality. But just as he began to realize his life's work, another train accident threatened to derail all of his plans.
Coming up, an engineering flaw threatens to upend the new Grand Central Terminal.
The CIA. They're the first line of defense for the United States, analyzing intelligence to thwart any possible threats and keep us safe. Some of their involvements are made public, and others aren't. Hi, it's Carter from Parcast, and in honor of America's birthday, we're uncovering the cases you were never supposed to know about in the new series, Conspiracy Theories CIA Edition. From international assassination plots and mind control experiments to catastrophic cover-ups and secret societies fit for film, sift through the agency's most questioned and controversial affairs. Each week, Conspiracy Theories CIA Edition exposes the covert operations intended to protect us from conflicts, but end up creating conspiracies. Where does the truth lie? Where do the lies end? And how much do we really want to know? Follow the new Spotify original from Parcast, Conspiracy Theories CIA Edition. Listen every Thursday, free and only on Spotify.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Now, back to the story.
Despite its high price tag, construction on the new Grand Central Terminal was approved in 1903. But just a few years later, another catastrophic crash rattled the project. In 1907, an evening train snaked through the Bronx when it flew off the tracks. 20 passengers died on impact, and another 150 were injured, eclipsing the 1902 carnage that had spawned the construction of Grand Central Terminal.
Chief Engineer William Wilgus knew why the accident happened. The railroad had identified a structural alignment issue, but hadn't fixed it yet, which made it a PR disaster waiting to happen. Wary of becoming the scapegoat, Wilgus kept careful documentation of the train's issues.
New York Central's chief counsel found out that Wilgus was hoarding the damning evidence and told him to destroy it. Wilgus played ball, but reportedly threatened to go public if the railroad ever tried to pin the blame on him.
It was a short-lived stalemate. By that July, Wilgus didn't even want his job anymore. Once he realized that railroad executives were redesigning the trains behind his back, he resigned.
Wilgus wasn't associated with Grand Central anymore, but they continued construction on his dream project, the new Grand Central Terminal.
The last train left the original depot in 1910. 3 years later, like a phoenix rising from the ashes, Grand Central Terminal opened for business on February 2nd, 1913.
Doors opened at midnight, and by 4 p.m. that day, 150,000 people had visited the new station. They ogled at a gargantuan main concourse that was more than half the size of the White House.
The PR team called the new digs, quote, a poem in stone. Hyperbolic as it may sound, they'd never seen anything like it. The blue-tinted cylindrical ceiling showcased 2,500 stars in a painting of the heavens. 50-foot-tall sculptures of Hercules, Minerva, and Mercury greeted onlookers from outside.
But the depot was missing its founding father. There's no record of Wilgus getting any credit for the new terminal when it opened.
However, there is a record of how quickly and extravagantly Grand Central Terminal supercharged its surrounding real estate.
The Biltmore Hotel opened up as part of the complex. It even had a direct elevator from the station into the lobby. Buoyed by the terminal, it became one of the quintessential New York addresses for socialites. There, car magnate Henry Ford tried to negotiate a peace deal before World War I. Later, novelists Scott and Zelda Fitzgerald stayed there for their honeymoon.
Soon after Grand Central opened, swanky venues like the Commodore Hotel and Yale Club began popping up. The famous 77-story Chrysler Building pierced through the skyline just a block away. Grand Central was now its own neighborhood, nicknamed Terminal City, and it was suddenly glamorous.
It also had a robust tunnel system that made commuting much more convenient. In 1926, 40,000 people could get home through Grand Central without ever stepping foot outside.
Even during the Great Depression, the terminal's retailers turned a profit. Grand Central had some 60 vendors, including oyster stands and flower shops. Altogether, they made $2 million a year in revenue for the station, about $31 million today.
The following decade, Grand Central turned into something of an arts district. The terminal had rotating exhibits and a newsreel movie theater.
Even the trains were hot commodities. In 1932, a commuter from Connecticut was so eager to catch his ride home at Grand Central that he stole an ambulance. He flipped the siren on to get there on time.
But he didn't make it. Instead, he rammed into a parked car on 44th Street and was arrested.
Grand Central had a cult following through most of the 1930s and 40s. But during World War II, it also became the site of a potential terrorist threat.
Its basement contains a hidden room known as M42. It's not on the building's official blueprint, and its existence wasn't even publicly acknowledged until 40 years after World War II ended. But during the height of the conflict, it was a secret power station.
M42 held Grand Central's original converters, machines that brought energy to most of the station's tracks. Legend has it that Nazi spies wanted to sabotage rail travel across America's eastern seaboard by sneaking into the basement to destroy them.
U.S. troops kept a watchful eye on the station. Soldiers were allegedly even posted there 24/7 to keep an eye out for trespassers.
What's more, Grand Central played a major role in transporting troops during the war. Thousands of soldiers funneled through its railways as they made their way to and from their deployments overseas. By the end of the war, Grand Central had reached its peak popularity. Over the course of 1947, 65 million passengers, over 40% of the U.S. population, passed through Grand Central.
The commotion even saved at least one person's life. According to Mary Lee Reed, Grand Central's resident organist, one day a man passed through the terminal on his way to jump off the Brooklyn Bridge.
He overheard her rendition of What a Friend We Have in Jesus and stopped in his tracks. He recognized the tune. It was his mom's favorite hymn.
Reed said, quote, it just broke his heart. Instead of jumping off the Brooklyn Bridge, he went to Cleveland and organized a mission, end quote. Something about the station evoked an almost religious zeal.
It was also a mainstay in pop culture. famous mid-century books, plays, and movies like The Catcher in the Rye, Death of a Salesman, and North by Northwest all prominently featured Grand Central.
President Harry S. Truman even spoke in the main concourse. As New York historian Sam Roberts put it, the terminal was, quote, America's living room.
But soon enough, all that hustle and bustle died down. The 1950s ushered in the convenience of traveling by car or plane. The terminal couldn't hold on to its long-distance passengers, and ridership plummeted. According to Roberts, in 1954, Grand Central only sent 18 long-distance weekday trains, compared to 32 trains 7 years prior. Railroad officials claimed the terminal was running an annual deficit of $24 million, some $230 million today.
Grand Central Terminal was in deep trouble.
New York City's builders, ever eager for more midtown skyscrapers, looked at the struggling landmark and saw an opportunity.
Rumors swirled of a proposed tower called the Hyperboloid. It would be a massive skyscraper designed by famous architect I.M. Pei, who would go on to design the Louvre Pyramid. At 108 stories, the Hyperboloid would have been 350 feet taller than the Empire State Building. In order to build it, Grand Central's main concourse would need to be demolished.
But New Yorkers wouldn't stand for it. More than 200 architects signed an open letter begging for the main concourse to stay put. They said Grand Central was, quote, one of those very few building achievements that has come to stand for our country.
Their line in the sand seemed to work. 4 years later, the developers modified their plan and built the sprawling MetLife building near the terminal, but not on top of it.
Grand Central was temporarily left alone, though hardly out of the woods. A hint of disasters to come lay 20 minutes across town at a rival train station.
Penn Station, like Grand Central, was a vast megaplex that served much of the tri-state area's commuter traffic. It had pink granite, 84 marble columns, and arched glass windows. Built 3 years before Grand Central Terminal, it was just as popular with commuters for the first half of the 20th century.
But by the 1960s, it was facing a similar decline in ridership. To add insult to injury, the decaying building was in utter disarray. Penn Station's roof leaked, and its owners had a hard time paying maintenance costs.
In 1961, the Pennsylvania Railroad optioned the air rights over Penn Station. 2 years later, most of its above-ground sections were torn down. The rubble above the tracks was turned into an office building and Madison Square Garden, where the New York Knicks play.
It was one of the country's biggest architectural tragedies. If you've ever traveled through Penn Station's dingy basement, you'd know why. The 600,000 passengers a day that walk through it walk as if they can't get out of the station fast enough.
However, the outcry against Penn Station's demise may have saved Grand Central from the same fate.
In 1965, the New York City Landmarks Preservation Commission formed. Its members sought to prevent the next Madison Square Garden. On August 6, 1967, they gave 11 New York buildings historical landmark status. Among them were Carnegie Hall, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and, you guessed it, Grand Central Terminal.
But the designation was only symbolic. The railroad ignored the commission and weeks later solicited architects to pitch new designs for skyscrapers. Many proposals called for bulldozing parts of the terminal.
It didn't help that the New York Central, the company that owned Grand Central Terminal, was hemorrhaging money. In 1968, they merged with the Pennsylvania Railroad, the same company that had just torn down Penn Station. 5 months later, yet another skyscraper deal was on the table.
This plan would have earned $3 million a year in air rights, but city officials thought it was a lousy idea. The new development would be right above Grand Central, meaning parts of the beloved terminal would have to be raised.
In 1969, the Landmarks Preservation Commission unanimously voted against the development. The railroad sued, insisting the disputed land was private property and that it was unconstitutional for someone who didn't own it to interfere.
Just over 5 years later, in 1975, the New York State Supreme Court heard the case and ruled in the railroad's favor, arguing the Landmarks Commission had no grounds to prevent it from selling air rights.
Pleas to preserve the terminal were loud but unconvincing. New York's Municipal Art Society corralled A-list lawyers and formed the Committee to Save Grand Central, desperate to drum up public support. But what the cause really needed was a prominent voice, someone people trusted, who they'd listen to.
Coming up, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis moves to save Grand Central.
If you went on a road trip and you didn't stop for a Big Mac or drop a crispy fry between the car seats or use your McDonald's bag as a placemat, then that wasn't a road trip. It was just a really long drive. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
At participating McDonald's.
Now, back to the story.
As the possibility of Grand Central being carved up by real estate developers loomed, in the early 1970s, various activists and celebrities joined the movement to preserve the terminal. And few were so prolific as Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis.
She was a beloved socialite, photographer, and of course, former First Lady of the United States. After organizing her first husband's funeral, she'd kept a low profile.
As a compassionate patron of the arts, she had a knack for preserving cultural gemstones. During John F. Kennedy's presidency, she'd restored all the public rooms in the White House and had saved D.C.'s Lafayette Square from being gutted to build office buildings.
Onassis also had old-school Manhattan lineage. Her grandfather, James T. Lee, was a real estate investor who'd helped turn New York into what it is today.
After seeing an art exhibit at the station, only to realize its potential demolition would mark the end of such events at Grand Central, she was ready to fight.
On February 24, 1975, Onassis handwrote a letter to New York's mayor, urging him to appeal the court decision. She said, quote,
"Is it not cruel to let our city die by degrees, stripped of all her proud monuments, until there will be nothing left of all her history and beauty to inspire our children? If they are not inspired by the past of our city, where will they find the strength to fight for her future?" End quote.
With her support, New York City appealed the state Supreme Court ruling and won, acknowledging Grand Central's status as a historical landmark. But the fight wasn't over.
The case eventually got kicked all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. The Committee to Save Grand Central and hundreds of its supporters took to D.C. in what became a landmark ruling about landmarks.
In June 1978, the Supreme Court voted 6-3 in favor of preserving Grand Central. The majority opinion ruled that cities can have some control over historic buildings, setting a precedent for architectural enthusiasts across the country.
But a pleasant court ruling still didn't solve the station's mounting bills. The railroad was still dead broke. Grand Central was dirty and in need of a makeover. And when New York City as a whole faced an economic downturn, it seemed the station might never be saved.
1970s New York wasn't the city's finest hour. After a sanitation strike, more than 55,000 tons of uncollected garbage littered the crowded streets. The city was bankrupt, as was the railroad company that owned Grand Central.
The terminal's roof leaked as commuters dodged gunky water and falling plaster. Its once precious stone wrinkled and chipped away. Steelwork rusted. Grime stained the ceilings, floors, and everything in between.
Ugly billboards and obnoxious advertisements littered the terminal concourse. A massive Kodak sign and advertising clock shut out the natural light.
All the while, nearby Midtown businesses struggled, and many shut down. One year, Grand Central even closed its doors every night from 1:30 to 5:30 a.m. It was ostensibly for routine cleaning, but they were also kicking out the unhoused people who sheltered in the underground train yards overnight.
But the end of the 1970s showed signs of life as the economy rebounded. The railroad sold off the hotels it owned near Grand Central. One of these was the Commodore, which got snapped up by a 29-year-old Donald Trump.
Now that Grand Central was around to stay, it had to be refurbished. In the 1980s, a suburban commuter rail service called Metro North took over Grand Central, intent on spearheading a massive revitalization effort.
The roof was priority number one. A football field's worth of copper needed replacing. Eight skylights had been blacked out for security reasons during World War II and needed the stale paint scraped off so new panes could be installed.
And the roof was just one piece of the restoration envisioned by the new president of Metro North, Peter Stengel.
Stengel had a near religious attachment to his beloved Grand Central. Once he found himself in charge of it, he spared no expense renovating it.
His colleagues worked like archaeologists digging for T-Rex fossils. They meticulously cataloged every piece of plaster, marble, and stone they could get their hands on.
By April 1990, Metro North declared a $425 million revitalization plan, angled at restoring the ceiling.
The celestial painting of 10 major constellations above the main concourse wasn't looking all that heavenly. A hole obstructed the scene, and the paint was peeling and stained.
The grime wasn't from soot or diesel fumes. It was 80 years worth of caked smoke from all the cigarettes puffed down below.
Once it was cleaned, the ceiling became one of the few places in Manhattan where you could see stars, if only painted ones.
In addition to the ceiling renovation, workers smoothed walls and cleaned floors. They even converted a waiting room into the glitzy Vanderbilt Hall, now a special event venue. They tore down a baggage storage area on the east side to build a marble staircase that matched the one on the west and installed new escalators.
Metro North didn't just tidy up. They retrofitted Grand Central to showcase its original design.
All in all, revitalization efforts created more than 2,000 jobs for New Yorkers.
Grand Central was rededicated on October 1, 1998. A New Yorker writer wrote tongue-in-cheek that the restoration, quote, managed the trick of making Grand Central look virginal while making it more commercial.
William J. Wilgus was long dead by this point, but that sounds a lot like what he was originally going for.
By the turn of the millennium, Grand Central was ready to accommodate a revived city.
But then, Manhattan faced its worst day in history.
While Grand Central's busiest day on record was in the summer of 1947, even more untallied people likely passed through on September 11, 2001. The Twin Towers collapsed, and commuters, some dirtied from the tragedy's debris, scrambled for any train out of the city.
But transit officials worried that Grand Central could be targeted in the next attack. So they evacuated the terminal and stopped incoming trains 80 blocks north at 125th Street. A single Metro North employee tried her best to map out the best detours for worried passengers.
Officials eventually opened up one exit and let passengers in one by one after searching their bags. Once people were in, they tried to get as far away from the city as possible. It was a harrowing day, but Grand Central Terminal offered escape.
Commuters probably would have been even more frightened had they known that Grand Central didn't have any emergency terrorist response system in place at the time. According to one of the control center operators, they were just winging it.
But the transit system has since stepped up its protocol. Now it has exhaust fans to stop the spread of smoke or toxic gas. There's also a souped-up camera system that can detect foul play at every corner.
Except maybe the secret corners.
Peter Calico, chairman of the Metropolitan Transit Authority, spotted one near an abandoned railway tunnel in 2003. He was surveying a new project to connect the Long Island Railroad to Grand Central. He and a few co-workers waited beneath the eastern side of the terminal, near where Track 61 used to be. Then, an old urban legend popped into his mind.
Rumor had it that President Franklin Delano Roosevelt had a private train car somewhere near here. Curious, Calico wandered down the abandoned shaft to see if he could find it.
But as he got closer, a throng of men popped out of the shadows to accost him. They were all wearing suits, and they had guns.
The men told Calico he wasn't allowed to go any further. Calico and his companions were confused. This was his railroad. Surely he could go wherever he wanted.
Normally, sure, but not that day. President George W. Bush was at a nearby hotel for a United Nations engagement. The Secret Service had cordoned off this section of the tunnel as a potential escape route.
Perhaps Bush's secret passageway had its own train car, the same one FDR had used.
Maybe the same one every U.S. president uses when they need to be discreet.
Next time, we'll explore some of the conspiracy theories surrounding the secret rooms, tracks, and passageways in Grand Central, like conspiracy theory number one. During World War II, Nazis sought to blow up a secret power station beneath the terminal.
Conspiracy theory number two, there's a secret armored train track reserved for U.S. presidents.
And conspiracy theory number three, the NYPD and other officials are waging an invisible war against the unhoused people that have lived beneath Grand Central for generations.
Grand Central Terminal is the United States' largest train station in its most populous city. With all the passengers and people that have funneled through, it's hard not to wonder what else lies beneath the surface.
Thanks for tuning in to Conspiracy Theories. We'll be back Wednesday with theories about Grand Central Terminal. For more information on this topic, we found Grand Central, How a Train Station Transformed America by Sam Roberts, particularly helpful to our research.
Until then, remember, the truth isn't always the best story.
And the official story isn't always the truth.
Conspiracy Theories is a Spotify original from Parcast. It is executive produced by Max and Ron Cutler. Sound design by Russell Nash, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Trent Williamson, Carly Madden, and Travis Clark. This episode of Conspiracy Theories was written by Jackson Knapp, with writing assistance by Angela Jorgensen and Mackenzie Moore. Fact-checking by Anya Bailey and research by Bradley Klein. Conspiracy Theories stars Molly Brandenburg and Carter Roy.
Hi, it's Carter from Parcast. Every Thursday on Conspiracy Theories CIA Edition, we're uncovering secrets hidden deep within the archives of the Central Intelligence Agency to bring you a special collection of episodes from shows across our network. Follow the new Spotify original from Parcast, Conspiracy Theories CIA Edition. Listen free only on Spotify.